श्री कृष्ण चैतन्य प्रभु नित्यानंद श्री अद्वैत गदाधर श्री गौर भक्त वृंद की जय। हरे कृष्ण। सो वी डिस्कस्ड जीवा मैटर कर्मा एंड वी सीन देयर बीन अ प्लान, अ वेरी केयरफुली कंस्ट्रक्टेड मटेरियल वर्ल्ड फॉर द जीवा with exact law, moral laws operating for the jiva to try to push him to use his free will. So how does that, why does that operate like that? So the answer is because there is someone who's got more intelligence who's planned the whole thing out. And that person is called God. So we discuss karma, matter, jiva. So we also have to discuss God, the Supreme Lord. So all this whole intricate plan of everything comes about because of the Supreme Lord. Prabhupada gives, of course, a simplistic argument, which scientists don't accept. Nevertheless, Prabhupada always gives this argument about some intelligence behind the material world. If we look at a flower, and we see a flower has got color to it, it's got a certain form to it, with little petals on it, and everything, a particular structure, which has been carefully planned out. Not all the same, similar flower has the same, structure. And if it's a good flower, of course, it has some scent to it. So, if we try to make a flower, with great intelligence, we can do something. It may look like a real flower. Sometimes they use them on the altar, artificial flowers. But it does take some intelligence to make that flower. We can't just hope that by accident after 2 years a flower will manifest from some elements like paper or something. It's not going to happen by itself. Someone has to cut the paper in a certain way, put a certain color on it, make it look exactly like this, and then put it all together in a way with using his intelligence and his hands. And then he'll make a flower. So just to make an imitation flower, it takes a lot of, know-how. Even an animal doesn't do that. Animal cannot make a flower. One human being can do that. But even that paper flower is not a real flower. This flower reproduces itself with seeds. And that flower doesn't do anything. So based on that, we can say that how is it possible then that we can say that everything ultimately arose simply by, chance combinations of atoms, etc., and gradually in complicated things, they ended up things like this. So it requires some intelligence. There's a more sophisticated argument than that. Sadaputta gives that in one of his leaflets. That is that if you take the law of chance and you start out with the simplest, combinations of elements coming together to make amino acids or something like that, which are the building blocks for proteins which make life. Now, if you take all the possible scenarios in the world of all the elements in the primordial soup clashing together over, so many thousands and thousands of years, or millions of years, the chances are, by the laws of chance, that they'll collide and they'll make, some protein molecules or amino acids that make protein molecules. It's very, very little. And that those can combine and form an actual life form simply by colliding together. It doesn't happen over billions of years. Just to get the simplest possible forms, which aren't even life yet, just the simplest possible building blocks of life, to get those to come together. When you have an ocean, he had a calculation of an ocean like a mile deep, covering the surface of the earth. We get the volume of that. We take the number of molecules there, and by chance we combine them all together and bump them together over a long period of time. And then, even then, it doesn't work out that you're going to get these combinations, particular combinations, in any sufficient quantity to make life, to make the building blocks of life. And then to combine those together to make actual life forms, even the simplest possible cell, one-celled organism, the simplest possible one, it's also a very complicated affair. And then to get them all cooperating together to make bigger bodies, it's almost impossible to conceive of how it happens. And of course, someone has written a book now on cellular biology to show that in cellular biology you cannot apply a theory of evolution. It doesn't work. Because things don't evolve like that. It's a very complex organism, and if you mutate one part of the organism, one part of a cell, the rest will not function. and the whole thing will die. So everything would have to mutate simultaneously at once in a certain plan to make something, you know, come out as a better eye or a better whatever. So just cells mutating haphazardly is not going to create anything. It's going to create disaster for the living entity. So there's no such thing as survival of the fittest type in terms of molecular biology. It doesn't work. Theory doesn't work anymore. So behind that, if there's going to be mutations causing us to have better and better life forms, it has to be very well orchestrated, not by chance. Things have to happen in a planned order to the mutations. Because everything is linked to everything else in the body, and you make one little mutation that's wrong, whole organism will die. So, therefore, you cannot have this gradual evolution by chance. You know, it doesn't work. So then we'll have to say, well, if it's not chance, what is it? And we get superior intelligence again. So even from the scientific point of view, then idea of some superior intelligence planning things out is a necessity. So that is actually what the scriptures tell us. There is a supreme intelligent authority behind everything in the material world, behind the jivas, matter, and the laws that govern both as karma. And so there's somebody behind there planning everything out very carefully. So that person who the final authority we call Supreme Lord or God. There may be secondary authorities. There are secondary authorities also. Those are devatas in the material world. They also have powers. They also have intelligence. But eventually we come back to one final source of everything. Just thinking about it, we always have this urge to think of some unifying factor in the whole universe. Now, if there's different personalities doing all sorts of different things, independently, you're not going to have unity at all. So it's more natural to think above all the personalities are doing something in this material world, all those devatas and above them, there must be some supreme person who's controlling everything in every single universe. So that one who's finally the final authority of everything, that person we call God or Ishvara, Supreme Lord. From our point of view, of course, when we think of God, there are many ways we can think of God. And according to our level of intelligence and gunas and whatever, our modes of nature, we will think of God, that Supreme Lord, in different ways according to our needs. So that is why there's different conceptions of God in the material world. People approach them in different ways. Even though they all believe in one God, their needs are different and they approach him, they see him in different ways. So we have different conceptions of that Supreme Lord, even though we say, oh yeah, we believe in the Supreme Lord. So there is some difference between religions and parts of religions. They all may believe in God, but their conceptions are slightly different. That's what makes them different religions. So in Bhagavad Gita also we'll see that these different conceptions are mentioned, are presented one after the other. We have... Of course, this is also explained in terms of Prabhupada mentions the five devatas, devata worship, the Panchapasana, which is Shiva, Durga, Surya, Ganesh, and Vishnu. And these the smartas worship the you know, these five deities, and then after they worship, and then they give them up, and they merge into Brahman. So anyway, the Durga represents Shakti. Shakti meaning energy meaning power in this material world. In other words, there's different things happening by some energy in this material world. Material energy is operating in such a way that things happen, rain falls, etc. So the person behind all of that ultimately is Durga Devi. She's in charge, Shakti. However, we can also think of the Supreme Lord as representing Shakti in some sense also. All the, a lot of religions, or rather simplistic, they will think of God as this, some power in the world. So it's directly related to material energy, that God somehow, you know, with the sun and the moon and the rain and the mountains and the rivers and things like that. So it may turn into nature worship or devata worship or whatever, and ultimately Durga worship. In India, it comes down to Durga finally, representing matter. And we're representing the power behind the matter in the material world. And there's some personality there. So that is one conception of God. That is represented in Bhagavad Gita to some degree also. Though this is, see, matter is not really God. We shouldn't say matter is God. It represents God only. In chapter 10 of Bhagavad Gita, there we have Krishna saying he's all the parts of material nature that are wonderful. All the power in material nature is actually represented by Krishna. And the best of the birds, Garuda, is represented by Krishna. The best tree, the Aswata tree, is represented by Krishna. The most powerful fish, the shark, is represented by Krishna. The biggest mountain, Himalaya, is represented by Krishna. So everything powerful in the material world, every species and every object, there's some supreme object there. It's all a manifestation of Krishna. So in that chapter, he's presenting himself as pervading material nature. So on a lesser level, people worship different devatas as representatives of material nature. But Krishna is saying, actually, I'm behind everything now. Devatas may also be behind. Behind the devatas, I'm also working. So ultimately, it's all representative of me. So that is one conception. God is nature. God is the laws of nature. God is power in the material world. That's probably the most primitive conception of God. We'll see. Appreciate God in the material world. Another, it's also represented in the next chapter, chapter 11, universal form, in a slightly different way, showing how God is like Paramatma within, in pervading the whole material world and controlling the whole world. But of course, Vishwarupa and Paramatma are slightly different in concept, because the Vishwarupa form, God is the world. The world is his body. The universe is the body of the Lord. It's imaginary, of course, but it's a conception for materialistic people that God and the body of the Lord is matter, like that. So again, that is representative of God as the world, a matter. Another way of looking at God, of course, that concept, people will worship God as power because of one reason, one motive, common motive, is fear. Because we're afraid of natural disasters in the material world. We worship the sun and the moon and whatever to get rid of those natural disasters. So basically, it's for our own material welfare that we do that worship. And we are praying to the controller of those things to, don't punish us. that's one. The other idea, which is quite related to that, is to see God as a supplier. We worship God and God gives us things. That becomes quite sophisticated in Karmakanda section of the Vedas. It's not so much by fear, but by kama, desire, that we're motivated. We want to enjoy nicely the material world, so we'll worship the devatas and we'll get nice results from them. So like in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says that the people who are in distress, they come to me. And people who are in desire wealth, they come to me. So there's two types of people, those who are suffering, and therefore they pray to the Lord out of fear and misery. And there's those who are coming because they want more, comforts of the material world. So those people who are looking for the comforts of the material world are more or less the Karmakandi people, like that. And those people, they will worship the Lord, understanding that the Lord gives you things. This is also represented in the Bhagavad Gita. In which chapter? One, two, three, four, five. Which chapter? Fourth chapter. God as supplier? No, that was the first one. Shakti. God is the world. Chapter three. Karma Yoga. Krishna says, worship the devatas. By worshiping the devatas, you get everything you need. If you don't worship the devatas and interrupt the cycle, then you don't get the rain and you don't get your food. You suffer. So you should always worship the devatas, he says. So that is, that's karma. Karma kanda. That we worship devatas to get our material needs satisfied. It is true. The Lord will do that. You can do worship the Lord directly for that, or you can go through the devatas, either way. Either way, it's material. So that's God as supplier. And the devatas are actually personalities in control of different aspects of the material world. Now, of course, science doesn't like that idea. I say this operates by its own laws. But no, it doesn't. The Supreme Lord is intelligent, putting out the laws, and he has his people there to make sure the laws get to go in a certain way. Just like in the government, we have one person at the head, and we have all the ministers, and we have the sub-ministers, and all the other people in the government, making sure things go on. So there's countless beings in the material world, all in different hierarchy, making sure everything goes on. It's also a very complex affair. Yeah? So the Lord has his servants there on all levels, from highest devatas to lowest devatas. And they're all doing have some functions in the material world, taking care of something. Yeah? So behind everything material, there's some protector, some deity there, doing something. So we should never think that, you know, it's just matter is just by itself. No, there's something behind there, behind a mountain, there's some spirit there of the mountain. And that's why the primitive people, they worship the mountain spirits or the tree spirit or whatever. Many types of spirits around. Some people in the West now, they also believe in devatas. You see books and they talk about devatas, because people, they have this idea. Some people see them, in fact. They see little, not the big devatas, but little devatas, like devata of the tomato plant or devata of the poppy, you know, whatever. They'll see, you know, like that. There was one couple in England, Findhorn, I think, Scotland, actually. They wanted to, you know, do some natural farming or whatever. So they started doing this, and along the way, they started hearing little voices. And the voices kept telling, you know, you got to plant it like this, you know. We want to plant the cabbage, you have to do it like this. You do it this way. And then they would decide, okay, we'll follow the instructions. And they started following the instructions, and then they started getting these huge cabbages, you know. And huge flowers, and in the middle of winter, they'd have roses blooming and everything like this, you know, because they were following these instructions. You know? So as they were doing this, actually they were communicating with different like spirits of the different plants. You know, each flower had its particular devata or something who would give them advice on how to grow roses or how to grow cabbages. And so you have a cabbage devata and a rose devata, potato devata, all these things. Huh? So in this way they were getting all those advices from different like spirits or something, you know, who were involved somehow with those plants, and they knew how they wanted to grow. So then, you know, they got advice and they grew some, you know, very far out plants that way. So then they understood there's some, you know, personalities with the plants also, not just the plants, but there's some personalities there also, kind of helping them along. So anyway, devatas are everywhere, and there's superior devatas, of course, and then ultimately beyond that, beyond them, above that is Brahma, who's controlled the whole material world, and then beyond that, then there's Supreme Lord. If we give respect and worship to those devatas or to the Supreme Lord, then we get a response. And if you don't respect, of course you get the opposite. So Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, if you don't do the yajna, then you won't get the results. If you don't recognize who's in charge, they won't respond and they won't give you anything. So therefore you have to recognize who's giving, at least you have to recognize that. You recognize that by offering something. So that's yajna, some worship. You offer something. That's a sign of your, let's say, your devotion or whatever, your recognition of them. So you give them something like a gift. So then they respond. You give them something, they give you something. This tends to get a little bit, let's say, materialistic, though, however, because we end up giving in order to receive. So it's not actually out of love. We see God as a supplier. And if we follow the order, if we follow the system of yajnas, etc., then God will supply. That's all. So it becomes like a mechanical venture in which we offer yajnas and we get our things and we're happy in the material world. So it's not a very elevated conception of God. It's a materialistic conception. God is there to satisfy our material needs, basically. We recognize authority. Yes, it works, so we follow it. The system works, so we recognize his authority, but ultimately we want to get our satisfaction in the material world, so it's not really spiritual. So that is one idea of God. This is present in all religions. It's in Christianity, in Judaism, in Islam, and Hinduism also is there. This conception of God is quite strong. Then, above that, we'll get to the spiritual conceptions of God, of which there are three. That's Brahman, Paramahansa, and Bhagavan. When we tend to inquire about spiritual life, then or something other than materialism, we get frustrated with karma, become dissatisfied even with sattva guna, we know there's something else there. And then we begin to inquire about spirit. Yeah? So if we inquire, then we may come to go, yes, this spirit is supreme. Yeah? So this becomes Brahman realization. We understand there's some eternal, unifying, intelligent source of everything. So if it's undifferentiated, we don't realize quite what it is, but there's something there. Then that is Brahman. Yes, there's something there. But we don't understand about form, qualities, activities of God or anything. So it's an undifferentiated realization of God. When we understand that there is a spiritual, intelligent being, a person, intelligent person, behind everything in the material world, operating everything, not just some vague something is there, but this is a person there who is, by his consciousness, pervading everything in the material world and making everything operate. And then we have Paramatma realization. This, however, is a conception of God which also isn't perfect, because it is a conception of God in relation to matter only and the material creation, and not separate from it. It's God, pervading the material world through his powers. So it's good because the people recognize Paramatma, or a person, but it is not perfect because they realize him only in relation to matter and creation of the creator of the worlds. Like that. And actually that's a secondary aspect of God. God is in the spiritual world where he has nothing to do with matter. So this is a secondary form of God. Most religions ultimately will come up to this level. Most commonly, God, the creator of the worlds, one who creates everything, and one who is omniscient and omnipotent, and that is God. So most religions have this idea of God, and they don't get much beyond that. Now that's in the higher forms of religion, where they believe in one God, Islam, Christianity, and Judaism. Then we come to Bhagavan realization. This means we realize that God is a person, as in Paramahansa, same person, but we realize him not in as a functional aspect of creation for creating material world, but as a personality in his own right with his own activities apart from the material world. So he has name, form, qualities, activities apart from the material world completely in the spiritual world. That is Bhagavan realization. So there's a particular way in which you can realize that. You can only realize that through devotion. That's all. You can't realize it by intellect or by yoga or anything else. Only by devotion you can realize that. In other words, it's through devotion that we get a realization of. And what does devotion mean? I mean, devotion obviously means we have a relationship with somebody. So by that relationship, then we get to understand who that person is. If we don't have a relationship, we're not going to understand much about them. So when we have that intimate relationship with a person, then we appreciate everything about the person, his form, qualities, activities. If you have a... if we give you a nice envelope, big envelope, and we put a picture of someone in there, and we seal it up, and we give it to you, and then we say, okay, now you have to love that person. The picture is in the envelope. You can't look at it. So it'll be very difficult for you. You don't know the name of the person. You don't know what they look like. You don't know what they do. You don't know the qualities or anything. And you're supposed to love the person. Well, how you can do it? Very difficult. So if we have a little information and we begin that establishing a relationship on that, then when we do that, then we get to learn more. And more and more and more when we actually have a relationship. Gradually the personality of God is revealed through devotional service. But in a process like yoga, basically, one is not so much interested in the personality of God. So therefore, he's not revealed. One does not have a personal relationship with God. It is shanta rasa only, neutral. So therefore, the understanding of God's qualities and his attractive nature is not much. So it's through devotion or bhakti that one realizes Bhagavan, personality of Godhead. Deva Goswami analyzes the word Bhagavan. In Sanskrit, they often do this. They analyze words according to syllables. Ba, ga, va, and they give meaning to each one. What is another word we have? Diksha. Di for divijnanam, ksha for samksaya. That means destruction. Destruction of sin and bestowal of divijnanam, transcendental knowledge. That's diksha. Divijnanam and papasya, samksaya. Those two things. So diksha. What's another word we have like that? Didn't we think of a word? There's a few words like that. Yeah. Anyway, Bhagavan. Ba. For? Apavarga. The word apavarga, Prabhupada translates. Apavarga. What is apavarga? Apa? Varga. Pavarga. From pavarga. And pa is different pa. Pa, pa, ba, ba. Which means, you know, death, mrityu, bhaya, fear, pa, parisram, pena, work, foam at the mouth, exhaustion, fear, pain, I think, pain, and then mrityu, death. This is pavarga. And apavarga means without that, so that means transcendental. So here we have bhagava. So bha for bharta. Bharta means one who nourishes, one who supports, one who maintains, one who establishes. So what does he establish? The devotees. He maintains the devotees. However, this could equally apply to Paramatma, because Paramatma also maintains the devotees. So in relation to bhakti, this nourishment means, in other words, he is a source of love and affection for the devotees. He's Bhakta Vatsala. And he nourishes them with his own love. So they get their ananda through his loving affection. So that is bharta, one who nourishes the devotee with his love. And ga'a, ga for gamayata, which means literally to make go, to make something go. So one who makes his devotee go to the transcendental abode. In other words, one who facilitates our entrance into the spiritual world. He makes us go to the spiritual world. Or it can mean one who creates all sorts of auspicious qualities within his devotees, one who manifests in his devotees all good qualities. Or one who grants pure love of God or prema to the devotee. One who makes that manifest in the devotee. So that's ga. And va, for vas. Vas means to live or to dwell. In whom all the living entities exist and who resides in all living entities. This, of course, can also refer to Paramatma. But also the Supreme Lord, as Bhagavan, also says the same thing, not because he is literally pervading everything, witnessing everything, but for the devotee, the Lord is in the devotee because of his attachment to the devotee. And the devotee is in the Lord because of his attachment to him. So they are intimately related through loving devotion, and they're inseparable. So in that, this sense, the Vas refers to that, that the devotee and the Lord are inseparable from each other. So that is Bhagavan. The other meaning of Bhagavan, of course, is that he's full of Bhaga. Bhaga means all auspicious qualities. So Aishwarya is there, Virya, Yasa, Shri, Jnana, and vairagya. So Aishvarya, that word. Okay, sure. Okay, fine. Aishvarya actually comes from the word Ishvara. Sometimes used to denote a majesty. Ishvara means the Lord. So Aishvarya means, we could say, opulence or majesty or grandeur or awe and veneration. Aishvarya. In this sense, of course, it means Aishvarya, from the word ish, or to rule over. It means he has a natural control of everything. Without any effort, he's naturally in control of everything. He's the number one controller. But he does not have to exert any effort to do that. It's just naturally there. By his very nature is that he does it. And virya. Virya refers to potency or power, etc., bravery, courage, things like this. We have virya rasa. Bravery rasa, courage is chivalry, chivalrous rasa. That's a virya rasa. So virya refers to someone who has great potencies, inconceivable potencies. So the Lord manifests that through his expanding himself into unlimited forms in the spiritual world and the material worlds for the pleasure of the devotees. And yasa. Yasa means fame. But one only becomes famous because of good qualities. So the Lord is endowed with all good qualities in relation to his spiritual body, his senses, his mind, his words. He has all sorts of qualities, like very, very wonderful qualities, topmost qualities. So the Lord has all these things in perfection, all good qualities in perfection. And Shri, of course, can refer to money, but actually money is, you know, a material thing. So the Lord is the abode of all good fortune of all sorts. That is all beauty, youthful form, etc., like that. And jnana, of course, is knowledge, omniscient. The Lord is aware of everything in spiritual world and material world. And vairagya, that means detachment from material world. Not affected at all by anything in the material world. Not contaminated, can never be contaminated or bewildered by the material world at all. The Lord is beyond that. So that's another meaning of Bhagavan. He has these six qualities. Now, when we have Bhagavan realization, if one is fortunate to get that far, even there, there's different types of Bhagavan realization. So broadly, we have the Aishvarya conception of God, the majesty of God, in which we know that this person is the controller of everything. He is God. And therefore, we view him with great awe and reverence and respect. So this is what we call the Aishvarya, or Mahima, realization of God. So in that category, we have all the different expansions of Vishnu in Vaikuntha, the Chaturvyuha, the different forms, Vasudeva and Pradyumna Aniruddha, Shankarshan, and their expansions. And these expand into the Paramatma forms in the material world, Mahavishnu, Garbhadakshaya Vishnu, Kshirodakshaya Vishnu. And so in this way we get the, you know, forms in the spiritual world and those in the material world. So these are all Aishvarya forms. And the other form of God, there's a few other variations, but the other form of God is the Madhurya form of God. So that Madhurya form is a realization of God without knowing him as God, without seeing him as God. In other words, we realize God in such an intimate way that we don't see his Aishvarya aspect, that this is God. So we worship God and we're attached to God, but we don't see him as God because that interferes with our relationship. So this is present only in Krishna. And only in Krishna in Gokul. Or Vrindavan. Not the Dwarka form, not the Mathura form. Only in the Gokul Vrindavan form. And that is the form of Madhurya. And that form also takes, that form of Krishna takes three forms. That is the Balya form, the Pauganda form, and the Kamara form. Three different forms. Of which the Kamara form is considered the most beautiful. That is his youthful form. Huh? And that is suitable for Madhurya Rasa, a conjugal relationship with the gopis. So that is why Lord Chaitanya, he glorified the love of the gopis and the relationship of Radha and Krishna as the highest, because it is the most sweet of all the different forms. So that is, we can say, the topmost form, the Madhurya form. So in recognizing God, we have to differentiate between God and Jiva. In India, this is a problem because they don't differentiate. In the West, of course, it's always there. In Christianity and Islam, there's a great difference between soul and God. In India, there's a tendency to think of them all, everybody's equal, God. This is due to impersonalism, Shankara's philosophy. However, the scripture itself points out it's not so. Jiva is definitely different from God. Devatas are also spirit souls like us. So they're not God. So we have to differentiate between the different personalities in this material world and their different powers, and their constitutional nature, whether they're Jiva or not Jiva. Because if we don't do that, then we'll be worshipping the wrong persons. So God is not a Jiva. He's completely different by constitution. He is Vibhu, we are Anu. He's omniscient, we're not omniscient. We have some knowledge, but not all knowledge. We are doers, but the Lord is the supreme doer. He's the controller of everything. So we have Anand, but the Lord has perfect Ananda, complete Ananda. So there's a difference. So of course, in the material world, sometimes the Jiva gets extraordinary powers also. So those are called Devatas. And sometimes Shaktivesh avatars. Jivas have special powers in the material world as Shaktivesh avatars, empowered positions. And Brahma in the material world, usually Jiva, he also has extraordinary powers. He's Guna avatar. So sometimes Jivas do get extra powers, but still constitutionally they're not God. So therefore in the material world we will have Jivas who do have extraordinary powers, but they're not God. The next personality, which is a little puzzling, is Shiva. Now Shiva is not a Jiva, but he's also not God. So that's a little bit strange. One sense he is God. But he's God with a specific function in relation to matter. And therefore we don't classify him as God because he is touching matter. So he's not a Jiva. He is in the category, he's sometimes classified in the category of Ishvara, or the Supreme Lord, because he's not a Jiva. He is an expansion of God, actually, with the powers of God. He has an eternal body. He does not grow old. He is omniscient. He has achintya shaktis, extraordinary powers. Now why we don't consider him as the Supreme Lord is because he is the form of the Lord who contacts matter directly. Sooner or later there has to be some contact between matter and God. So he does it through Lord Shiva. So Shiva is the one who directly is instrumental in handling material nature. So he's different from God, he's also different from Shiva. More powerful than Shiva, less powerful than God, because he's in contact with matter. We know from Nectar Devotion that Jiva has, 50 qualities in part, and Shiva can have 55 qualities. Some extra qualities are there. And Vishnu has 60 qualities. He has more powers than Lord Shiva. More powers are manifested. So that, of course, is in relation, a lot of these qualities are in relation to Paramatma. What makes him different from Shiva is that Vishnu He is the one who has the power to manifest the material worlds. Shiva is a secondary instrument of that. But primarily it comes from Vishnu. Therefore, we have a description of Mahavishnu lying down on the causal ocean and glancing and instigating the material worlds to manifest themselves. So the final cause is, our power is with Vishnu. So he's the one who has that power. Shiva does not have that power. And he has that ability to expand himself in so many forms in the material world as avatars. And nobody else does that. Shiva doesn't do that. And he's a monitor of the jivas in the material world. His paramatma pervades everything and witnesses everything. Shiva doesn't do that either. He has powers that even Lord Shiva hasn't got, Achintya Shakti. He liberates even his enemies. He liberates. He has the power to liberate. And he has the power to liberate even his enemies. He'll kill them and then get liberated. So Shiva doesn't do that either. And even if one gets liberation, Vishnu becomes attracted to that person. In other words, an Atma Rama, even an Atma Rama becomes attracted to the Supreme Lord. One who has impersonal realization can become attracted. So those powers are different from Jivas and from Shiva. And then Krishna, how is he different? He is different not because of powers, not because of avatar forms, not because of all this. He is different because of his sweetness. And so Krishna has four special qualities that Vishnu doesn't have. One is beautiful form. That does not mean that Vishnu is not beautiful. He's also very beautiful. And once he's Vishnu, one will realize what spiritual beauty is. It's very wonderful. But it's a particular type of beauty. And that is its madhurya rupa, which means very sweet. Vishnu is very beautiful, but he's very majestic in that beauty. Krishna is beautiful, but is very sweet, informal. Not grand. So there's a difference there. His form is not even adult form. It is a young boy. So he's very harmless and not authoritative. And he does not dress like a king. He puts on a simple dhoti, puts a peacock feather in his hair, decorates himself with mud, earth and things like that, plays around in the dirt. So his form is quite different from God. So it invokes great intimacy, that form. So it's a madhurya rupa. It's a sweet form. Krishna has special leelas. Now, any form of God has leela, and they're all wonderful, whether it's Varaha or Nrisingadeva or Vishnu. They all have eternal leelas. But Krishna's is madhurya, or very sweet. In his leelas, nobody sees him as God. They see him as their son, their lover, or their friend. So madhurya leela in the activities. Vishnu also has the devotees. He has countless devotees in the spiritual world. Krishna also has devotees. But the devotees are in, and they're all in prema also. But this is in madhurya prema, the devotees of Krishna are. That is in vatsalya rasa and in sakya rasa and shringara rasa. And even dasya rasa is madhurya. And everything in Goloka is madhurya, very, very sweet, intimate. And in Vaikuntha, generally, you don't get the rasas, any rasa except dasya rasa, or servitude. And that is not madhurya, it is aishwarya. It is with great awe and reverence. So that is the difference. The devotees are different there. So all the devotees in Goloka are in a very intimate relationship with Krishna in their rasas. And those in Vaikuntha are in dasya rasa and aishwarya mode. The last quality of Krishna is his venu madhurya, or the sweetness of his flute. Of course, Krishna's sweet in all ways, very sweet in all ways. But this flute also has a very special attraction to it. When he plays his flute, then that instigates immediately prema and all the people that hear it. They all faint because of the prema. So it's a very special flute. And what prema it gives not the prema of Vaikuntha, but it gives that intimate, loving relationship in Vrindavan, which is very madhurya. So this flute of Krishna has very special power for that. Krishna does not hold shankha and chakra and all this, and these are all authority symbols, the symbols of God. So Krishna doesn't hold those things at all. Instead, he just plays a flute. So these are the four qualities that distinguish Krishna from Vishnu. And they're all sweet qualities, sweet forms, sweet activities, sweet devotees, and sweet flute. The skeptics, one who's skeptical, of course, will think, what is this? How does this make God so special? He's all these little sweet things. But it's a matter of rasa, actually. It's a matter of the taste that one derives from one's relationship with God. So for those who prefer that intimate relationship, that intense relationship, they worship Krishna. I cannot worship Vishnu for that. I only worship Krishna. So this relationship is more intense than other forms of relationship. That's Aishwarya relationship. It's much more intense. And therefore, Krishna is the highest because of that. Because he embodies these rasas in their full extent. Okay. So we discussed previously how through karma in the material world and ignorance we're acting, then we're subject to karma and we are in a dependent state completely. With association, by determination, we can begin to rise out of that state and become responsible, recognize the law of karma, and come to a stage where we can actually get control over our future. We can make goals, establish goals, set goals for ourselves, and we can direct ourselves with great certainty into the future. So that is the independent level. So we go from dependent to independent level. That is, we're not dependent upon matter anymore. We are a little detached from it, and we can actually use matter, not be controlled by it. So that is the first step. In terms of gunas, we go from tamagun to rajagun to sattvagun. In tamagun, basically we do violent activities for sense gratification. That is called vikarma. So we get very bad results from that. We have to suffer a lot. In rajagun, we are also desirous of enjoyment, like in tamagun, but we're willing to regulate ourselves to get that enjoyment. We understand there has to be some rules. So that is the level of karma, where you regulate your activities. However, though there's this abidance by rules, it's actually a little devious, because we're abiding by rules in order to get our enjoyment. Not because we respect the rules, but we have to get it to get our enjoyment. So, a little devious. In other words, we're still trying to exploit everything else. But we'll follow certain rules and regulations in doing it. If we're in the sattvic mode, then we do follow regulations also. But we're detached. We're not trying to use those rules to get our enjoyment anymore. We follow the rules because they're rules, that's all. Set up by the Lord. This is the stage of nishkama karma. We do the same things as in karma, but without personal motivated desires. So nishkama karma. So in this stage we begin to understand the law of karma and that we do have some responsibility in the world. So at this stage we begin to actually determine where we're going to go in life. We can actually do that intelligently. So when we get to sattvagun and we understand karma, then the next stage is to understand our spiritual nature. If we only go up to sattva, that is not enough. Then we have to get to the spiritual level and understand we're not matter, we're spirit. Now in there, also in spiritual life, then we got a choice. We got choice. We're independent, living in it. We got free will, so we can choose which type of spiritual life we want, which type of realization we want. So that is where prayojana comes in. We choose a particular process for the particular goal we want. So in bhakti, what do we want? Prema, Krishna prema. That's the prayojana or the goal. So the process that leads there is bhakti. Bhakti will lead to prema. But by our free will, we don't have to choose that. We can choose a different goal. One goal is the negative goal. My goal is to get out of the material world. Goal is to stop my suffering. Goal is to stop my karma. So this is what the Gyanis have in mind. That is called liberation. I'll give up the material body, gross and subtle. I'll escape from karma. So that's the goal of the Gyani. It's a negative goal. As a result of that, his realization of God is very diffused. Not very specific. Without individuality. One can also choose yoga, the path of yoga. One wants to realize God as the creator of the material world, the pervader of the material world, then you choose yoga. So this is also not a full realization of God, because it's only one aspect of God, who is the creator of the world. He's also in the spiritual world. So it's incomplete. Anyway, we have a choice. We are independent. When we come to sattva, then we have choice. We can decide our goal spiritual. Then we can decide what type of spiritual goal we want. We want to realize God as a person, we want to realize Him impersonally, we want to realize Him as control of the world. And then we have choice then. There is, so even for God, there is free will for choosing what form of God we want. And even in bhakti, there's also a free will. You can choose to worship any form you want. There's avatar forms like Narasimha Dev. You can worship that. Rama is there. Krishna is there. So you got all sorts of choices even in God. Which type of God you want. So therefore, independence will lead us to spiritual choice. In the material world, independence will lead us to, of course, determining our own material goals. Which will have principles behind them, let's say, ethical principles behind them. And will also lead to cooperative ventures in the material world, because we're not alone. We usually work with other people. So when we become independent, then naturally, in relating to other people, then we'll have some sort of, we may act as a leader of other people. We have to establish relationships, proper relationships. So that is the stage of, we call interdependence, working for interdependence. Once we're independent, then we can establish interdependence. If we don't have the independence first, and we're not using our free will, then there's no hope of actually successfully communicating with other people. Unless we know ourselves first, then we can begin to communicate and know other people. Difficult. Interrelations are based upon our own, first our own knowledge of ourselves. So therefore we go from independence, that is when we do have our self activated, then we can go into interaction with other people in the material world. So there are several things there. One is that in interacting, and there's different motives. We have different motives. And the form it takes is dualistic in interactions, based upon our false ego and ignorance. Ignorance means suffering or enjoyment, basically. These are the two options in the material world. So in terms of relationships also, interrelationships and interactions with other people, our relationships will also reflect that. So generally, it becomes dualistic. And our relationships based on enjoyment for ourself. So a relationship is basically I win, you lose. I enjoy, you suffer. And if I don't enjoy, I suffer, and you enjoy. So it's like, you know, like that. So it's problematic, of course, because everybody wants to enjoy. Nobody does want to get the suffering. But unfortunately, we end up with that. Someone enjoys, somebody suffers. So this is a normal relationship in the material world. We want to enjoy, so we have to get something. If I get something, somebody else loses. So this is the win-lose paradigm. In terms of managerial capacities, interacting with others, it leads to the authoritarian system of leadership. I'm the controller here. So I get the benefits. You are my workers. I will exploit you. So I want to enjoy, you want to enjoy, but I'm more powerful than you are. So I have the right to utilize my authority to get my enjoyment, and you have to suffer. So that's one type of management. It doesn't work too well, because as I said, everybody wants to get the enjoyment. So the workers will resent that. They're getting exploited, and they'll revolt, or they'll have unions and whatever. So it's not a very good way of interacting in business or in relationships or whatever. But it's normal. It's a normal position. Because we have this stuck in our mind, we have to get our enjoyment. So if I get it, then you don't get it. There are other forms it can take also. The other form is if one is very, very weak, then one will choose the lose-win paradigm, where I lose and you win. Voluntarily, we'll let the other people take advantage. So this is also not a very successful, it's not a very practical mode of operation, because we'll never get anything accomplished. We'll simply get exploited over and over again, and we'll never get our goals achieved. We can't achieve anything because somebody else is going to keep winning and we lose. So it's not a very good way of acting. In leadership, this is called permissiveness. Let everyone do whatever they want. Because it's too difficult to control everybody. So we'll let everybody have their own desires fulfilled, and they can do whatever they want. It's permissive leadership. One may do this because we want to get some authority or some strength based on popularity. So if we agree to what everybody says and we become popular, then we'll later exert our authority. This is the motive behind it. In doing so, we compromise our principles and everything. So basically, everybody gets what they want. You don't get what you want. So it's not a very good system. And it tends to destroy the structure of authority. Another is lose-lose. This is very tamasic. In which we know we can't win, so we don't want anyone else to win either. So I can't enjoy, I'll make it so you can't enjoy either. We'll both suffer. Those revengeful tactics in the material world. So what we call this is the basis of war, destructive wars. We'll fight a war not so because we want so much, but we don't want anyone else to get it. So we'll just have a war so that nobody else can get anything. And of course, very tamasic people or highly dependent people will operate in this mode. Not just working so that nobody gets anything. So ultimately, it's unproductive for everybody. It's a bad situation. Another paradigm is a very very egocentric paradigm. Is just win. I win. That's it. We don't think anything anybody else. We just want to, we want to get the enjoyment finished. We don't think about anybody else. Huh? So we don't think about anybody. Then, the other one is, it's called win-win. That means we want to get our goals fulfilled, but we operate in such a way that the other person doesn't have to lose either. So that we get mutual benefit, in other words, in relationships or in business or in whatever, organizational thing. Everybody gets their advantage, what they need. Huh? Now, it doesn't seem possible from one point of view because, you know, in the material world, it is dualistic, you know. I take, somebody loses. So therefore, we'll think that you can't have a situation like that where both people benefit. If there's two companies, generally, it is win-lose. I will make my profits, you only get the profits. So I win, you lose. My company succeeds, yours fails. We can't think of both companies succeeding and cooperating. It's competition. This is the, in the business world, this is the new idea that we're not trying to destroy everybody else and conquer over everybody else. Rather, we try to work for mutual advantage of everybody. And in relationships between people, we're not trying to just exploit everybody else. We have to get our goals satisfied, but we also want to see that everybody else gets satisfied also. So this is a more humanistic approach to relationships. And based on principles, our behavior is principles. In other words, if people are proactive in nature, then they can do this. Work for win-win relationships. And if they're not, if they're basically dependent people, then it'll be win-lose or lose-win or lose-lose or win. Those other types of interactions. So what does it take to have such relationships, beneficial, mutual beneficial relationship? One, character. There must be integrity, principles behind everything. When I say solid foundation and principles. Otherwise, there'll be no trust. Now, in this mentality of character, it was called the abundance mentality. The opposite is the scarcity mentality. That is, there's not enough for everybody, so I got to take it now. And if I take it, then you're not going to get it. Scarcity mentality. The other mentality is abundance. There's enough for everybody. I can have, you can also have. So even if I take to my sufficient needs, still there's enough for you also. Just like Prabhupada said, there's enough food in the world. It's not that everyone's starving. There's enough food there. It's just how we distribute it. That's all. And there's enough for. There's nothing. Not there in the material world. So this is the abundance mentality. The Lord has sufficient for everybody in this material world for to satisfy our needs, and there's no shortage actually. So this is the this is one of the principles that of character that the one who's in the win-win paradigm has. So how we can think like that? We think like that because we act according to our principles. We act according to our values. We have security. So we're not afraid of taking risks in the material world. We have our standards we live by. We are holistic. We have wisdom, so we understand that everything's related with everything else in the material world. There's some plan behind everything. And if you know, we cooperate with the plan of God, then everything works out. There's enough for everybody. So therefore, we work with proper character. Then we can establish relationships, productive relationships, win-win. So win-win character, our own character is necessary, and relationship is necessary. One has to establish a proper relationship. So there's two things. One, ourself, we have to have integrity. Second, we have to build a relationship. of trust with another person. Otherwise, they won't. There will be no exchange, honest exchange of ideas, unless there's trust between the two people. How does trust arise? From interaction, a good experience in interaction. They have what's called the emotional bank account, and that is if you do something for somebody, they remember it. You do something without motivation, you do something for someone, then they feel, okay, this person's good. If you don't do anything, they don't know. But if you do something for another person, it's a good person, you can trust them. You know. So if you do enough for a person like that without expecting anything in return, then he gets a good feeling towards you, then there's trust. So sometimes it'll take something like that to build up trust before you can establish relationships and operate on a win-win platform. So your character is important. Establishing relationships is also important. Then there should be agreements. This is, of course, we're getting very technical now, but there should be performance agreements if we're actually managing things. This isn't management, actual technical management. There should be actual agreements, not just up in the air things. They should all be put down in very, very specifics. One, you should define what you're looking for. What are your goals? If we're acting together and we're trying to figure out what to do, we should figure out what our goals are, my goals, your goals. Define the results, when we're going to get the results, what results we're supposed to get out of all this activity we're doing, business or whatever. We should define very clearly. And we have to set up guidelines. How we're going to achieve them, with what limits we're going to achieve these goals. You know, we have to put limits someplace. So what are the limits? What are the resources? What manpower? What money? What knowledge we need? What skills we need? Those have to be defined also. Accountability has to be there. The quality of performance of executing the goal. Or we can sadhana bhakti, we can say. or sadhana. And there should be a period of evaluation. When are we going to accomplish it? When are we going to check and see if we're going in the right direction? So there should be a time for evaluation. And last, consequences. So we evaluate. Then what do we do next? If we're not up to standard, what happens? If we are up to standard, what do we do next? So consequences. So all these things are there. Define the results. Have guidelines. Set up the resources, set up accountability, and then figure out what the consequences should be in case of, you know, failure or success or whatever. So these things have to be defined in, you know, relationships also. In companies, or between companies, or between individuals or whatever, working together. This, of course, is in achieving some goals, you know? So, in the win-win system also, there should be a reward system. This, of course, we're talking about maybe managers and then workers or stuff like that. But it's not that we give one person something and we don't give another person something. This goes back to win-lose. You can't do that. So definitely we should recognize people for their performance. But rather than give individuals, it is better to reward groups for their overall performance rather than one person being better than the other or whatever like that. So you reward the whole group rather than the individual. And we have schemes where it's groups rather than individuals and performing. In this process, there are four steps of trying to get some, you know, a mutual beneficial solution to things, whatever, between two parties. One, one has to see the problem from the other person's point of view. One cannot put oneself in the center all the time. And so we have to see exactly what that person is worried about, what his needs are, what his concerns are, what his worries are, everything from his point of view. Why he wants to do this? Why is the stress? Why is he worried about this? Why he doesn't want to cooperate or whatever? So we have to take the other person's point of view. And then we have to sit back again and be a little objective. Then we have to try to figure out what are the main issues involved. Often we go through big discussions and they go around in circles. We can't figure out what's happening, you know? So we have to figure out what the main issue is actually. You have to figure out what the main issue of contention is, why there's a disagreement. Yeah? So we have to figure out that. Yeah? And then thirdly, we determine what results would be agreeable to both parties. Huh? Or what would the final result be? Would it be agreeable to both? And then we have to think of options, how to get those results. What are the ways, different ways we could, paths we could take to achieve those results which are acceptable to both of us. Huh? So that is the process of getting a solution to a problem, huh? A mutual beneficial solution. Operating on this level is not a technique, actually. It's not a technique, but it's rather a way of living, we can say. If it's a technique, then it comes down to manipulation again. And then everyone will distrust you because of that. So it's actually a new way of relating with people in the material world, actually. A new paradigm of living, so to speak. Okay, let's cover one more thing. Okay. So we spoke about the win-win solution, and one of the points was relationship. Yeah? You've got to establish a relationship of some sort, a trustworthy relationship first before you can accomplish anything. That entails, of course, in that deal, to try to understand the other person from his point of view. And so that's one of the other points. First seek to understand before you present your point of view. So you try to understand the other person first rather than push your points forward, your understanding. So respect the other person, in other words. So what happens usually in relating with other people who have problems, or when there is a problem, we will diagnose, we'll prescribe before diagnosing. We'll make up our mind what's good for this person before we even figure out what this problem is, you know? So we have to take time to listen very carefully and try to understand the problem, whatever it is. The other person may also not be very clear about what his problem is. He may not know either. So we have to be very, very careful and try to figure out what it is, you know, and identify the issue, ultimate issue of the problem. And you have to listen very carefully and try to understand the other person's point of view. Then we can get some sort of idea about it, some clue. But as I said, trust is important there. If they don't think that they can trust you, then they'll become very defensive about everything. So that trust has to be there, you know, to try to understand another person. They have to think that, understand that you're actually trying to help and you're not trying to exploit them. So one of the skills is called empathic listening, where you listen from a superior point of view or trying to analyze anything, but rather sympathetically. We try to put ourselves in their shoes and listen to what they're saying, and then from that understand the problem from their point of view. In the material world, generally we have four responses to another person. We'll evaluate. and we'll probe, we'll advise, and we'll interpret. Well, this is what we'll do with another person. Huh? Evaluate means, yes, I agree with you, or no, I don't agree with you, basically. So you just make a decision, I like it or I don't like it. Huh? The probe is you ask questions, but from your frame of reference, you ask, you know, from your point of view, different questions to the person. Advice, you give advice based on your experiences. Huh? And interpretation, you'll try to speculate on why the person is doing this or why the person is doing that. Huh? Based on your own experiences. So basically all these are self-centered. We're thinking of the other person in terms of ourself. And then we're interpreting or whatever, passing judgment on that person according to our own mentality. Huh? So if you do that, then basically there's no communication. So you have to get beyond that and try to figure it out from the other person's point of view what the problem is. And then we can communicate. And so this is an important step, therefore, in resolving problems, to get a mutual beneficial solution. First we have to, you know, understand, seek to understand by listening very carefully. So in Greek philosophy, they have three principles: ethos, pathos, and logos. Ethos means your integrity or your trustworthiness, which is based upon your conduct. Yeah, it's based upon your actual conduct and your character and your values. Your example, in other words. So that is necessary. Credibility. Pathos means to have sympathy or a feeling for the other person. So one has to identify with the other person's problem. Logos means reasoning. So generally, to make things simple, we go to reasoning and we intellectualize everything about the person from our point of view and try to find out the problem from our mind, our intellect, let's say intellect. But that actually doesn't really get to the problem, actually. So we have to use you have to have ethos, your own sense of, personal qualities and conduct in order for trustworthiness. And secondly, you have to be sympathetic to the other person's point of view. Then after you do that, then you can use the logic to figure things out. So logic is important, but don't go there first. You put your reasoning power to operation after you've understood the other person and the other person trusts you. So first the person trusts you, then he opens up. Then you can try to understand what his real problem is. Then you can use your logic to try to come to a solution. But if you just try to apply logic in the beginning, it's not going to work because you're not communicating. So what you can do is think of some sort of solution and present it, keeping in mind their own needs, and also explain the logic behind that using your intelligence. You can do that. You should present your ideas clearly, specifically, visually, understanding the context, that is their own situation. And if you do that, then the person is likely to accept your proposal. If you do it because you're genuinely doing it to help the person so he gets benefit, then he'll accept. At the same time, the proposal is such that if you're a manager or leader like that, you don't want to get exploited. So it's advantageous to you, but it's also advantageous to him. You're working for something which is good for both people. So this is a principle in relationships. The last principle is interesting. With one person, of course, we do things, we set goals and we achieve our goals. It's one thing. When we act in groups, it looks a little more difficult because there's a little lack of control. Everybody's an individual, yeah? And they're all going in all sorts of directions. And the whole idea of management and leadership is to bring them together. And then the leader has to, and the managers have to put a lot of energy into trying to keep the whole group together. If we develop first proactivity and responsibility among the members, and we have trusting relationships, communications, understanding, and an idea of mutual advantage, win-win. When all that is there in the group, then it becomes much easier to get results. So in normal, like in mathematics, 2 plus 2 is 4. 4 plus 4 is 8. That's normal, you know, things put together. And in business, of course, if you have so many laborers and so much money, capital, then you can get so much result. And if you had more money and more people, then you get more result. And you can mathematically calculate, you know, how much result you're going to get. It's a logical thing. Through experience, you can calculate that. With people in relationship, trustworthy relationships, or acting in proactivity, when they come together and interact as laborers, managers, and whatever in a company or in a group and organization, it's not predictable anymore. It'll go beyond, the end result will be beyond the predictable result. If we have the same number of people, the same finances, you get better results. In other words, 2 plus 2 is equal to 6 instead of 4. And 4 plus 4 is equal to 12 instead of 8. So in other words, it's called synergy. The result of the parts is more than one would predict. The total is worth more, becomes more than the parts, the sum total of the parts. That's called synergy, where the individuals come together and they produce an unexpected product, greater product. So why is that? That is because if there is trust in relationships in an organization or a group, then everyone becomes enthusiastic. And therefore they produce to their best, their maximum. They go beyond the normal limits of production, each one. And normal relationships, you do your minimum. We do our work and we go away. We don't care about the quality. Because we don't respect anybody in the company or whatever organization. We just do the minimum and go away. But if one has synergy and trust and enthusiasm for the goals of the company and whatever, because they treat you nice, therefore you're willing to sacrifice more and more. And you put forth the best effort and try to have high quality work. So then the same amount of people will give better results. That's called synergy. So in synergy, there are many people at work. So the key is that we don't suppress people and we don't try to fit them all in one mold. Rather, we have to acknowledge that everybody's an individual and he has individual needs and individual differences, etc., and even individual capacities and skills, necessarily. But we try to fit everybody in such a way it's beneficial for everybody. He benefits, you benefit. So this is a creative process of work. It's a creative process, and it takes risk. Take risk. But if one is proactive, then one has what we call security. We have an inner sense of confidence, so we're willing to take those risks. So the steps in synergy are security, built upon, we have our goals and all this, we have our standards, and we have our ethical conduct, we've got our personality goals, everything like this in mind, internal principles. But the world is at risk to do anything in the current world. But if you have these principles behind you, then you have security. You're willing to take risks. Why? Because we at least we have our internal values to work by. We're stable. Hmm. We'll need to take chances. Huh? So we have that security behind us. Respect. That is, of course, as relationships are important. Trustworthiness is important. So one has to respect all the other people and the other members. There should be a high emotional bank account among all the members. Huh? A very trustworthy group. Huh? There must be communication. That means, of course, listening to the other person and establishing modes of win-win rather than win-lose or lose-lose or lose-win. And creativity. We have to use our intelligence, our inspiration, to come up with new alternatives. Not stick to the old formulas or anything. Huh? Because the world is always changing and there's always new problems coming up and new conflicts coming up. So we have to figure out, use our ingenuity and our inspiration to find new solutions to everything. Huh? So it takes creativity. Okay, that's synergy. The opposite of synergy is negative synergy. That's produced by the win-lose approach to things. So you get another type of energy coming out through that approach. In which you put up all your effort, but nothing happens. It's like going down the road with your foot on the gas and the other foot on the brake. You're trying to put all the energy in and nothing happens. You stop at the same time. So then your foot is on the brake and you're not moving. You apply more gas. More gas, more gas. So what this means is that the person in one position, superior person, let's say, so he has to keep pushing to assert his authority, and when he does so, and to get his will, you know, accomplished, and then the people under him automatically resist. Huh? So therefore, there's no production because all the energy is going into one hand, making the people obey, and the other people are resisting backwards. So then they stop production, and then you don't get anything done. So it's very non-cooperative, yeah? That approach. The win-lose situation gives rise to a situation where ultimately conflict arises. And conflict, when there's conflict, then there's no productivity, no creativity, no productivity. So basically the world, in the material world, the only way you can relate is interdependence, not by that win-win relationships, not win-lose or lose-win. That's the only way you can actually be successful in the material world. But it won't work if all the people are dependent people. Because basically the psychology is win-lose. And they're not secure. They don't want to take risks. So therefore, they can't have interdependent relationships in the material world. There'll be exploitative relationships. And they'll always be trying to manipulate other people. And there'll be no trust. Therefore, there'll be insecurity. So the result will be chaos. So, if we want interpersonal synergy, that is highly productive, positive energy coming out of relationships, then it's based upon personal synergy from within ourselves. So the interpersonal is from the intrapersonal. So we have within ourselves also synergy operating. Production of results, energy, etc. Capacity to get goals achieved from within ourselves. If we have that capacity, then we can develop the interpersonal synergy also. So the interpersonal synergy, internal synergy, is based on the first three things, that is proactivity, setting goals, and setting up your priorities properly. That is important, not urgent, rather than unimportant, non-urgent, and all the other combinations. So that we have to cultivate that first. That's the inner victory. Once we do that, then we can establish the external victory. That is the interpersonal relationship from dependence to independence, independence to interdependence. So this way we can actually achieve something. I'll just read something here. The essence of synergy is to value the mental, emotional, and psychological differences between people. The key to valuing these differences is to realize that all people see the world not as it is, but as they are. In other words, we all have our paradigm of existence, and everybody's is different. It's not what the world is, but how we see the world. So we have to realize that that's what everybody has, a different vision of what the world is and what everybody else is. They're not like you. So we have to realize that and see the differences. The person who is truly effective has the humility and reverence to recognize his own perceptual limitations and to appreciate the rich resources available through interaction with the hearts and minds of other human beings. In other words, we learn to appreciate other people's paradigms, not our own point of view only. Not that the one is right and one is wrong, but we can accept them both as partially true. That two people can disagree and both are right is not logical. It's psychological. And it's very real. We see the same thing but interpret it differently because of our conditioning. Unless we value the differences in our perceptions and understand that life is not always dichotomous either or, that there are almost always third alternatives, we will never be able to transcend the limits of our conditioning. To produce synergy, the concepts of win-win, mutual understanding, and seeking synergy are used to work directly on the restraining forces. Involving people in the problem so they understand it makes it their problem, they tend to become an important part of the solution. As a result, shared goals are created, enabling the whole enterprise to move upward. So, that's synergy. So, just to summarize now. First, a few quotes from various sources. If you're not sure where you're going, you'll probably end up going somewhere else. The main thing is to keep the main thing the main thing. And usually we go off and do something else. Huh? Where there is no vision, the people perish. So we have to have goals, but we also have to be practical enough to achieve them. If we don't have any goals, then, of course, nothing is accomplished. Okay, just to summarize. Change begins with the self. Change is possible, but it takes effort. We can change ourselves more easily than changing somebody else or changing the world. So if we want change, change yourself first. It's the easiest thing to do. By becoming responsible for our decisions and actions, we gain the power to create our future. In other words, this is how we overcome karma. By taking the responsibility for our decisions and our actions and our responses. We should choose our goals. We should define goals and choose them using our intelligence, aspirations, and imagination. We should focus on the goals constantly as one's life and soul. And so it's like sadhana. You have to keep repeating it every day. Every day. Keep repeating the goal. Then it will sink in sooner or later. Right? Practice will produce results. Only practice will produce results. Don't think that you'll get anything by doing nothing. Huh? So you have to practice to get results. If you have a goal, then you have to do something to get the results. Daily drill the mind to accept new paradigms, new habits, and new goals. Goals must include acting according to eternal principles by which we live, values from the eternal but individual soul. So the goals are not only material things, they have to have ethical and spiritual qualities to them. What we cannot change, we accept as the grace of God. Some things we can't do anything about, a certain situation, especially the whole world, the world condition, we can't do anything about it. So we have to accept it. By becoming independent and proactive, we increase our circle of influence. By changing ourselves, we change others to proactivity. In other words, we're not a good example. No one else is going to be a good example either. Huh? So first, we have to act properly, control our lives, set our goals, be detached from the, you know, ups and downs of the material world. And then, this can influence other people. Strive for mutual benefit rather than personal gain at others' expenses. Understand with openness the position of others and communicate clearly our own needs and goals. Everyone is an individual, everyone is different. Build a third alternative based on the differences. One should be confident. That is produced through the first three things, that is proactivity, setting goals, priorities. Caring. That is number four, win-win solutions. Trustworthy, that is understanding the other person's position. And when all these things come together, we get dynamic results. That is synergy. We get what we want, and we get more. And beyond the predicted results, we get more than that. That is synergy. So once that is established, that's not the end of things. It's not that once it's fixed like that. Because once you get up to this stage, the seventh principle is you go back around the back to the beginning again and you start all over. And you start at the bottom with your goals. And you redefine your goals again in terms of what you've achieved already. Set up new goals and everything. And then you start again and you start start a whole new process again with new realizations. Redefine the goals and then start everything up again. So it's a dynamic process. It's called what, a spiral, ascending spiral. Now, here's a little problem. We did this in our thing in Madras, actually. There was two little things. Anyway, let's read it out. Okay, there's a nurse in a hospital. We have a lot of nurses around here, eh? Healthcare people. Anyway, there's a nurse in the hospital, and she has one very troublesome patient she has to take care of. He has cancer, and he's not supposed to live for maybe a month. But unfortunately, he lived beyond the expected result, and he's living longer. And we don't know when he's going to die. But the problem is, he's the most troublesome person on the earth. And no matter how what you do for him, all he does is complain and call everybody names and create the worst situation. So this nurse is in charge of this person, and she's driving him. He's driving her crazy. Because whatever she does, all he does is complain and make problems and insult and do the worst thing, uses foul language, so that she cannot even get near him anymore. Every time she gets near the person or sees him, she starts having some sort of problem. But at the same time, she's got her duties to perform, and she's got to do all the stuff for that person, and, you know, take the food in and clean up after him and everything, and she can't stand it. So nobody likes this person. Other nurses don't like him. Nobody likes this person. So she's having a problem. She can't stand working there anymore. She can't stand, she even has a problem when she goes home. She can't even think properly when she goes home at night because this problem, this person is so insulting and and doing so many bad things that she's just very disturbed over the situation. She's very tense, so that family problems arise from that. Yeah? Children are crying, she screams and whatever. So that situation is affecting her whole life. Her husband, everything is upset. So, what's she supposed to do? She's working because she needs money. But she's in this awful situation, and she's simply falling apart. And that's making the whole family fall apart also. So what should she do? Should she tolerate and just keep the money? Or should she sacrifice her family and make the whole family fall apart? What is she supposed to do in the situation?
Find out his problems, why he's doing it.
Find out why he's doing it.
According to the scenario that's being presented.
Huh?
He's an unapproachable person.
Well, definitely, yeah. He's,
so you can't have a discussion with
true. Because he's not up to that level of...
He's not
it would take a long... He'd probably die before it happened. It takes so long to establish that relationship. Huh? Get a transfer. Okay. Okay, get a transfer. That's one thing she can do.
That's not my wife's problem. She might have someone else.
Huh? What's that?
That's not my wife's problem because she might have cancer someone
else. That's true. Yeah.
I'm just showing love and then not.
Just show him love, but he still screams. Kill him off. Yeah, kill him off.
Thank you.
If we find something that he likes to
okay, so we could be compassionate and somehow maybe figure out his problem or do something. Like we try that. Okay.
Philosophical suffering.
Oh, I see. It's my karma to do this. Huh? Okay. Anything else?
Try and stay happy still.
Oh, I see. Okay. Yeah. Well, the basic thing here, this is based on actual experience.
Ask him about his life.
Mm-hmm. Ask him about his life. Okay, well, that's like probing, isn't it?
Yeah, usually all people like to talk about it.
Yeah. Okay. She has to tolerate and suffer. She has to suffer through the whole thing and destroy her family in the process.
At some point, which you've got to be sensible by the degree of tolerance, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's not destroying just her, it's destroying her family and her whole peace of mind. And she's unable, according to the scenario you presented, to tolerate.
Yeah, she's falling apart.
An unacceptable situation for her. Yeah. We'll give you the duty. That's not it. The whole point of this is to learn some of these things. You're not empathizing even with the main character. Well,
This was based on an actual incident that happened, actually. Somebody was in one of these classes, and then she stood up, and she was very excited. So then afterwards, the person said, what happened? And she said, well, yeah, I was listening to all this, and you're saying, you know, so many nice things and all that. But, you know, it's such an impossible situation for me because I had this stupid person there, and I had to tolerate all day long. But then finally she realized through all the whole thing that, actually... Yes, this man is very bad in many ways. You know, he's so bad and like that. But then she came to the realization, that's got nothing to do with me. That's his problem. It's not my problem. So why I should suffer? He may say whatever he wants to say or do whatever he wants to do. It's got nothing to do with me. Let him do whatever he wants to do. Why I should be affected by that? So then she had a realization. She was very happy. She could go back to the man and do anything, and he could say anything. No problem. So in other words, she controlled her response to the situation. That was that's the simplest way of doing it. In other words, control yourself first. Work on yourself first. It's easier than trying to control other people. Second, you can try to do that also. And she probably can do that now that she's in this sense of control, and she's not affected by him in any way. But if it's the other way around and she is affected and then she's trying to do something, then the other person will detect that actually she's doing this because she just wants to get rid of me or something like that. You know? So therefore it'll be like exploitative, where she has a motive in trying to be nice to him in order to make him so that she doesn't get her problems like that. But if she is very detached from the whole situation, not affected at all, then he will probably listen to her in the long run.
Maharaj, this seems to come back to the point you were saying before, where, you know, I don't know whether the rest of you have got, but I've had similar sort of experiences with persons of this nature, and you're stuck in a situation. You can't just run away and leave them or whatever.
Yeah.
That you have to suffer a little sometimes before you realise. You don't immediately react, well, it's not my problem, you react.
Yeah.
Why is this guy having a go at me? Da, da, da.
Yeah.
And after a bit of suffering, then you go, well, it's his problem.
Through your actual emotions and whatever you do, then you finally realize that, why I should be emotional at all? It's causing me problem. His problem is causing me problem when it shouldn't. It's his problem. If he's miserable, he's miserable. Why is his problem making me miserable? It doesn't have to do that. Yeah. So it's a realization we get when we get a little bit of that misery on ourselves. Then we realize it's not my problem.
I think that example you gave about the German...
Frankl.
And also we have those... And so we know that being a soul, we are always full in abundance. We don't worry aloof of this material nature anyway.
Yeah.
So with that, knowing that we're always, that's what we're always supposed to be, always giving, because we are already full by itself.
True. Yeah.
So we are always Chitamanda. So
yeah.
This situation actually can never hurt us anyway.
Mm.
So the soul cannot die, cannot be soul, cannot become anything.
Yeah.
So if it's affected us, then we identify ourselves with the body.
If you think of our body, obviously, then we're going to be subject to, you know, misery or whatever. Okay, then. That's all. Okay. Haribol.